Welcome. Good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect it's approximately 3:34 p.m. on this Friday, March 18th, 2011. Let the record reflect we have a quorum. In fact, the entire committee is with us here today, beginning on my left, Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, co-chair Senator Wagner, to the beginning of the far right, Senator McGuire, Senator French, Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Senator Pasquin. Today's hearing, we are continuing with the presentation on Senate Bill 49. We are pleased to welcome Mr. Bob George of Gaffney Klein and Associates, who will offer a presentation on petroleum fiscal system design, so that the viewing public has a little bit of knowledge of Gaffney Klein. Their website in part states, quote, an international advisory firm focused on the provision of integrated technical and managerial services plus independent advice to all sectors of the oil and gas industry, close quote, and that they do work all over the world. I'll also ask Mr. George to elaborate briefly on his credential and Gaffney Klein's past work here in Alaska. Gaffney Klein is a consultant that is paid by the administration, but again, we do welcome them here today to the Senate Resources Committee. I would make sure the committee members understand that the slide presentation is approximately, I think it's 21 pages long, and Mr. George is only here today. He is not available next week, so therefore we need to progress through those slides so that we can finish in an hour and a half. So with that, Mr. George, please identify yourself by stating your name and give us a little bit of who you are, and then begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob George. I'm Vice President and General Manager of Gaffney Klein Associates, or GCA as we are often known. And as you pointed out in your introduction, we are a global petroleum consultancy. I'm based in Houston. I have about 38 years experience in the industry, and something over 30 years of those have been with Gaffney Klein in various locations around the world. Although my original training was as a geologist, my main area of experience has been more in the sort of commercial and strategic side of the business. My work involves sort of two aspects of things often, sort of valuation work and commercial opinions associated with acquisitions and divestitures, companies, finance raising and fiduciary reporting, and just sort of dispute resolution. Clients for this type of work would include the major oil companies, independent oil companies, banks, financial institutions, and also taxation agencies such as the IRS. Other major areas of work I undertake is with governments, ministries, and national oil companies, advising them in areas such as petroleum policy, licensing, fiscal design in there. Clients that we have had in there include a number of major producing countries such as Venezuela, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Mexico, and we are currently engaged by the Ministry of Oil in Iraq, helping them with their petroleum licensing policy, and have been involved in that since 2008 and the last three license awards that have taken place over the last couple of years there with many of the major companies from the world involved in that. GCA was first engaged by the Department of Revenue in the middle of 2007, where we undertook an analysis of, comparative analysis of several countries' fiscal regimes for them. And following that, were engaged in the fall of 2007 in the special legislative session on ACES here. And both myself and my colleague Rich Ruggiero, who's also been up in during this session as well, were involved pretty much throughout that session there. In 2008, we provided support on gas line economics. The AGEA conference that was in Anchorage in, I think, May of that year, and subsequently the special legislative hearings that took place here in Juneau in the middle of 2008. Since then, we've had ongoing support for the department on a number of issues, mostly for fiscal issues, economic modeling, and so forth, and have appeared in the legislative session, certainly last year and I think the year before as well, testifying to certain issues on the fiscal front, particularly last year on the issue of gas and oil decoupling in there. We're currently engaged by the Department of Revenue under a contract that began in the middle of 2010, middle of last year, and is capable of running for 2 years. So I hope that provides sufficient background for everyone. So there's been...
Mr. George, brief at ease.
So I put together some slides this afternoon to try and address some issues and follow on comments made by my colleague Rich Ruggiero in another place earlier about a month ago on here, and really try and go to some of the issues that you know are facing everyone at the moment and yourselves on this committee among them. I mean, what we have on the slide here is the production history and short-term production outlook for the North Slope on there. And there's nothing new in that respect. And everyone's wrestling with a question at the moment is the decline that is being seen in there, is that a function really, as I put up there, of nature or of nurture? Is it what you know you're going to expect because that's what is capable of being delivered? Or is it that it's a function of things are being governed by the way that that activity is taking place under fiscal, contractual, and regulatory systems that's out here? I don't think there's any easy answer.
Senator Stedman?
Could we back up, please?
Sure.
I don't know, Mr. Chairman, how you want to do it. If we have questions on the slides or wait till the end, or how do you want to do it?
I think as he's... proceeding through it, it would probably be the most relevant.
Okay. When we look at the production curve, and we can look at just Prudhoe, or we can look at the aggregate here, is this a normal type production curve that you'd expect to see in an oil basin around the globe?
Yeah, it's certainly not unusual to see production that rises up, will hold for a plateau, maybe relatively short, or maybe a few years, and then will decline in the sort of, you know, mid 5%, 6%, 7% range, and off. Now, do you get sort of second life in some of these? Yes, you do see that in some basins. Do you have differently shaped profiles? Yes, you will see those in some places, particularly in areas where you have more closely managed operations in there. For example, you know, a lot of the Middle Eastern countries, you'll see production profiles that will not exhibit something quite like this because the resources are being developed and exploited at a much slower rate relative to the amount of resource in the ground. But if you were to look at some North Sea ones, for example, you'd see shapes that look pretty much like this.
And then, because there's a lot of talk about this in the press and a lot of hype, so what you're telling us is this is something similar to what we would have expected back when we opened up the basin. You know, it's a near decade of very steep increases in production, then a decade of fairly good decline, and then it's tapering off for some time out in the future, depending on the type of basin. That's kind of what you're saying? This is something that...
It's certainly not an unusual shape to it in there, yes.
So when you sit down and do a model to try to figure out the fiscal system or even, you know, a subcomponent of it along the way, incremental investment, would you use something like this, some pattern like this, to try to put a timing and a magnitude of the cash flows? Or how do you do that when you build your model?
yeah, you would assume that there would be a period where you'd be building production, whether you're applying it to a field or whether you're applying it to a broader area, a basin or a location, whatever, you would have some sort of plateau duration, which wouldn't be exactly flat, but would run along at some higher level. And, you know, that would be important for design, for example, when you're looking at capacity of facilities and things like that, what sort of level you might design that for. And then you would assume that you would have a period where the thing would decline away. I mean, again, it may be a relatively steady decline, or it may be that there's the second or even and third areas of periods where you get some build-up again in there, perhaps not quite as high as the peak, but nevertheless come up again before falling off at some later stage. That would not be unusual.
Just another follow-up. And then so you know, sometime in this time frame, similar to where we're now, it could be expected there would be most likely a review of the fiscal policy to take a look and see if we can't stem the decline. And you find that fairly common, where the sovereign or what have you wants to sit down and try to extend the life of their basin as long as possible?
That has happened in a number of countries and continues to happen, and I would expect it to continue to happen, yes.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
For purpose of the record, we should identify that Senator Thomas has been in the audience with us, I believe, since the beginning, so just recognizing his presence here. I don't see any other elected officials, but Senator French had a question.
And maybe it's more of a comment, but I'd be happy to hear Mr. George's thoughts on this. And it's looking at this chart, you know, if you take, it's almost like we have two different universes in Alaska, the Prudhoe universe and then everything else. If you take Prudhoe out of there, if you go back to the highest year of production, that was 1988, it looks like there was about 500,000 other oil barrels flowing into the pipeline that year. If you look today, I think we have about 350,000 other oil barrels flowing into the pipeline, an extremely modest rate of decline over those years. To what degree do we have this one super field that we need to worry about, or can we do anything about it? And to what degree are we just looking for smaller fields to fill a decline that's based on everything besides Prudhoe? Does that make sense?
I would say I'm always hesitant using the word unusual, but you would typically expect some form of distribution of size in there that would give you a fairly broad spread on there, to have one sort of particularly big outlier and then you know, lots of small ones would not be so usual, but I think there probably are other examples of that around the world. But, you know, hard to say unusual. Would you expect that you could find more? Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's been testimony that there are people who know certainly way more than I do about the geology up on the slope there that believe there are significant volumes still to find up there if you go and explore for it. And you can go to very mature basins where there have been lots of wells drilled, go down to the Gulf of Mexico, you know, people go back again and everyone thinks they've played out, and people go back in and find them and give them a new lease of life within the area. That's not unusual either.
Just one quick follow-up, and that is with respect to just the Prudhoe Reservoir, don't all reservoirs decline? Or let me put it another way, has there ever been a reservoir that didn't decline over time?
No, I don't know the answer specifically to your last question, but what your question goes to a bit is the mechanism of pressure depletion in the reservoir, the energy that drives the oil out. Now, if it's a completely closed system, no, it will decline away in there. If you have very, very strong support from an aquifer, for example, coming in, or artificially you put it in with water or gas or injecting something else, you can maintain pressure in there and hold the rate up. But over time, yes, you would expect to see decline. Yeah.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. George, good to see you back. I know that we in the past had joked that you and Rich Ruggiero had spent so much time here that you were probably going to become eligible for a permanent fund dividend check.
So still waiting for
So hope to see more of you as we move down the path. Your advice to us in the past has been really invaluable, and I want to thank you for that. You were very instrumental, your office, in helping us develop ACES, and so your perspectives on it is really important to us. Does this slide take into account the impacts of Repsol's announcement to spend $768 million in Alaska exploration. And also, if you could talk a minute about the shale oil, if you have any expertise on that. We had a presentation by Great Bear. They talked about really phenomenal shale oil assets on the North Slope. They believed, we've had Department of Natural Resources there as well. I'm curious to hear your take on that, whether you think the potential exists in Alaska to really bump up this decline curve with the shale oil and also with the Repsol and other companies that have come into Alaska since the passage of ACES.
Senator Wachowski, through the chair, the profile out there does not take into account any of the exploration on there. It takes into account resources that have already been discovered and are somewhere in the system of development or evaluation and may come forward. But stuff that has not been discovered yet, that does not appear in any profile like that. With regard to the shale oil resources, this is a difficult one. There's no doubt you have very, very rich source rock up here, so you have the sort of generating capacity for it. But the big thing about whether it's oil or gas, and oil is more difficult to flow than gas out of there, out of these sort of resource plays, is you have to create the pathway to, it's sort of almost like creating an artificial reservoir with stimulation on there. And the key issue in this particular case, as in every single case of this, is going to be the evaluation work in the drilling and then the stimulation and completion of the wells to see what sort of rates can be flowed out of the wells. And a feature in particular, I mean, Senator French asked about decline just now. This is one of the features on you know, wells that have been stimulated like this, is that they start at a rate and then decline very, very rapidly, and then typically have a long tail, or at least we think they're going to have a long tail. But one of the problems the industry has is it's all so new that we're projecting a long tail, but we don't have enough track record to really say that for sure it is going to be the case. Could it add significantly to it? I really don't know. I mean, but we've been surprised. I mentioned in my opening there that one of the things we assisted the Department of Revenue on was in the hearing in the conference on AGEA in the middle of 2008 with respect to the forthcoming confirmation of the bill to fund the AGEA process. And there were a lot of presentations up there with regard to gas outlook for the lower 48 and of gas pricing. And gas at the time was sitting at a fairly high price up there. And you didn't hear one peep in the whole of that conference about the impact of shale gas on the lower 48 and supply there. That was less than 3 years ago. So I might feel, yeah, someone comes along and says, we've got this great resource, we can do something with it ever so quickly, and it sounds very, very rosy, and, you know, is it really going to be? But, you know, this has really taken the industry by surprise, the extent and the rate to which opportunities have come on board. So I don't know, but could it happen? Sure. I mean, it is happening right now elsewhere at a very rapid pace.
Just as a follow-up on slide 2, which is on the screen right now, if I understand what you say, then the decline in production that's shown on this slide is in part a normal life cycle of a large petroleum basin?
It is not unusual, indeed, for that.
Please continue, Mr. George.
I pinched this slide from my colleague's presentation recently on fiscal system design. I think the only real point I want to make up there is that this is not an exact science. Nothing is black and white in it. And as it says up there, it's you know, two parts art to one part science. There's a substantial amount of judgment. It's not just a question of saying, you know, the right answer is you have a 60% or a 70% government take and you know, that's it. It'll work for all time, and it's the only way you can go. It's a whole host of issues as to how it's put together, the way it operates, all the other factors that sit around it, the nature of opportunities in the area, alternate opportunities, competition that's sitting out there from elsewhere. It's not even a static situation. Something that is appropriate at one point in time may not be appropriate at another point in time. Again, you try and build into your system something that has a degree of flexibility such that it will respond to changing environmental factors, and again, environmental being, you know, not so much just the land and so on, but the prevailing oil price. We have a situation, you know, now with unfortunately in Japan, and so the question is sort of the whole energy balance. You know, what else that may impact that may have on the situation. You know, the labor force, the maturity of the basin, you know, is there success, is there not success? People's perceptions are very important in all this, because emotion does play a role in everything going forward. So, you know, you go in designing these things, and you look at the institutional capacity to manage it and so forth, and what is appropriate in one place is not necessarily appropriate in another. So there's a lot of judgments go into these things, and that's really the point to leave.
Mr. George, you use the term basin maturity, and just so that the viewing public may understand exactly what you mean by that term, could you more fully explain basin maturity?
Yes, it's the degree to which you think you have information with regard to how well you know the basin. The more work you do in it, the more wells you drill in it, the more broadly you drill those wells in it, the better you understand it. And the degree to which you have extracted the amount that you ultimately think you're going to get all sort of contribute to the concept of maturity in there. Now, that perception of maturity may change over time as well. You learn new things, you have surprises from time to time, you may find that you're not as mature as you thought you were, or sometimes things start declining a lot faster than you thought they were going to, and you find perhaps you're a bit more mature than you thought you were. But it's a concept of through the lifestyle, the expected lifespan, should I say, I'm sorry, of a basin or an area, whereabouts you think you are in this.
When it comes to conventional oil, do you have an opinion as to the basin maturity of the North Slope Prudhoe-Kuparuk region?
Well, I guess if you look at the area of the North Slope that has been developed, that's probably into a fairly well-known stage. Maturity has some complexities there as well, because there's a lot of resource that is known up there, and by resource I mean there is oil and gas that has been discovered but is not subject to commercial exploitation at the moment. Heavy oil would be a very good example. The volumes that are known to exist in the ground are very, very large. The degree to which they may be extracted commercially is a subject of you know, greater question in there, and the way that they may be got out in the future, the extent to which they may be got out in the future. So, you know, that could change the perception of maturity, for example, is if the key to that was unlocked in the relatively near future. You know, people may say, well, we're actually not quite as mature as we thought we were, because we've actually now got a lot more opportunity we can do. Someone makes another discovery and do it. It's certainly, you know, it looks into the, it's certainly well middle-aged, but, you know, could you have another life ahead of you there? That's possible as well.
Thank you. Please continue, Mr. George.
Someone asked me the question a little while ago, actually. I think it was Senator Stedman there. He said, you know, would you expect fiscal systems to change, or is it unusual for fiscal systems to change? It's not unusual at all. There is an issue that sits out there with regard to stability, and companies are concerned about this issue of stability. Do they feel comfortable that if they make an investment, things are going to remain at least within a reasonable band, close enough that they're going to get the sort of levels of return they were expected going into something, at least from the fiscal side of it? So there is that. But to be responsive to changing circumstances has proved positive as well. I mean, I'm from the UK. It's used quite often as a benchmark of an area where the fiscal regime has changed many, many times. Generally successfully, not always. There have been moves that have not been so good, but they've changed and continue to change. They changed again. No, they added a change. They didn't necessarily tear everything up, but they made changes again to encourage development of some aspects like heavy oil, high pressure, high temperature oil in there, and small fields, and gave encouragement for that because they felt it wasn't getting as much attention as perhaps there was potential for. So doing that sort of thing is not unusual in there. Systems change again, and we saw a lot of that in the sort of 2005 through 2008 window, where fiscal regimes that had been set up in an era when everyone sort of had a mentality of $20 oil. I mean, it fluctuated a bit, but at the end of the day, it kept reverting to about $20 oil. And most of them were set up with a perception of costs and opportunity in that range. And when we started to move out of that in the 2003-2005 window, and everyone said, well, is it going to stay? Is it not going to stay? Yes, we think it is going to stay now. We saw a lot of change come on the back of that as well. So there are all those factors that drive change in there. And other times, as I say, it's you think, are we getting what we should expect from this level of pricing and opportunity from a technical perspective on a pre-tax basis? Are we getting as much as we might expect out of it? And you make a decision at that point, well, maybe we're not, and we can make some changes that will encourage things to happen that otherwise may not happen. It's a judgmental issue, but that's what those are drivers.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and Mr. George, it's good to see you again. But and a question for you on this slide, slide four, the stars indicates the two are not always the same or even nearly the same. And I guess my question for you, my observation of it in reading about other countries that have relied on petroleum as a basis for their economy, and then, of course, looking at our own changes that we've made here from ELF to PPT and back again, and then I guess I would say looking at Alberta, one of our closest neighbors, it actually seems to me to be that we fluctuate exactly between the two. It's not only that they're not the same or even nearly the same, but we fight as a government between those two policies exactly. And it seems as if we can't figure out which one we're at. So we want our fair share. And then we set about crafting a policy and overreach or get what we think should have been our fair share. And the industry, lo and behold, says too much. And we're going to back out and move to Saskatchewan or North Dakota and not invest. And then the government comes back and says, whoa, we want to attract investment in industry now. And that's our new goal. That's what we really want. And I guess I'd just like to hear a little bit of discussion from your past experience in working with other governmental regimes about that mix between those two goals.
It is a continuous competitive tension, I guess, is the way to I might phrase that. That there are going to be pulls from both directions. Is it easy to overreach when you do something? Sure it is. Have you overreached? Very difficult to say on there. I mean, in any government where they're doing it, the period of time over which you measure things can sometimes be very small relative to what it is to really gauge a response, particularly when you have, fairly major global factors going on at the same time on there. Competition isn't always one-on-one. It's not we do it here or we do it there. I mean, companies operate in lots of countries at the same time. But competition is something, obviously, that is a balance. And something that may not be working today may work tomorrow. It may be that the competitive situation changes and it proves fine, or it may be that you want, but timing to you may be more important. So maybe you want to say, well, okay, I don't want to wait till tomorrow. I want it now. And therefore, you may make some changes on that. It obviously is not good if you swing too wildly between endpoints, if you like, on there. You try and avoid those things on there. But does it happen, and will it continue to happen, not just here, but everywhere else? Yes, I would expect that is going to be the case, always.
Senator Willikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. George, you mentioned that some of the other countries that your firm has been involved in designing or assisting in the tax structures there included Venezuela, Brazil, Kuwait, Iraq. I guess Rich has been going back and forth, earning a lot of frequent flyer miles to Iraq lately. How does Alaska's government take compare with the government takes in those countries?
Venezuela. I would say Venezuela, it would be less than on an average basis. If I talk at the effective take as opposed to the marginal take, which has some slightly different issues associated with it, but on average take, it would be less than in Venezuela, but you have a lot of other issues right now in Venezuela. And at the time we were working down there, which was in the early, well, through the middle of the 1990s, things were going in the opposite direction there. They were opening up and they were making it easier for the companies, and we were sort of creating structures that allowed a sharing that attracted a lot of money into the country at that point in time. In Brazil currently, the Alaskan take would be not dissimilar to it, maybe slightly higher at current oil prices. Brazil's is not geared to oil price in the way that Alaska's fiscal regime is. So at current oil prices, it would be higher. At lower oil prices, Alaska's would be lower. And again, a feature that was built into the system and has actually worked pretty well, I think, from the perspective of prices crashing to mid-30s in 2008. Where else did we have? In terms of Iraq, very different structure for the fiscal regime there. I mean, the rates you will hear quoted out there is that the take in Iraq is north of 90%. But we have, what's actually happening is that a number of the contracts in there are actually in existing producing oil fields that are one of which is doing around 1 million barrels a day. And the contract is not to, hand over the oil field for nothing. I mean, basically, all of that is basically being kept by the host country. And when you look at the 90%, you're including the bit that's been that the host country is retaining. In terms of Saudi Arabia, that was a structure for the gas industry that they're in there. They still do not have any gas production. They have activity, but no gas production under that. The rates went higher than here, but they were also based on a rate of return concept, so started out at somewhat lower rates in there. And Kuwait was again a service contract structure, and it's not difficult to it's not possible to give an exact answer on that, but I would say it's probably higher.
Kuwait would be higher than?
Yeah, again, but under a sort of service contract type structure where you have a lot of known resource that you're developing on behalf of the government. So, and most of those structures are ones where you get your money back and then an element of profit that's sitting on top of that.
Please continue, Mr. George.
Okay. The bottom half, large bullet on the slide, again, was how do you deal with the change? How do you justify it if indeed it's felt to be justified? And it's a combination of things, which really goes back to the second slide I had in there about part art, part science, or mathematics in this case. And so you're doing a number of calculations based on what if this, what if that, to try and certainly, when I do these things, I like to see a range of outcomes, try and get some sense of if we move over here, what does it look like? If we go over there, what does it look like? And you just try and build some sort of mental picture of where the responsiveness is, where difficult areas are. And then the subjective calculations are trying to make judgments as to, where things may in fact go. And that's always a very, very difficult thing because it's just subject, Forecasting is a very difficult subject. Anyone who does it for a living knows that they will see, if they ever get a real success, they're doing very, very well because you never hit it right on.
Is it, Mr. George, accurate that whether it's the objective calculation or the subjective calculation, that that should be overlaid on the basin maturity concept that we previously described?
Yes, I think absolutely. What you might look at one point in time in the maturity and expectation curve. I mean, maturity is also perhaps a surrogate word for expectation, the degree to which you feel you know something, how well you know it. And what you do before you know and prove anything, maybe one set of terms. If you're in a sort of highly successful, very easy to get in mode, depends a bit about how you award acreage as well, may affect the way you structure your tax regime. You'll have it in another, and in a more mature phase, you may change and break it out into different components, maybe even to reflect the need to address different things within the what you know is going on at the moment. Okay, well, we're kind of touching on some points that have come out in the conversation and questions anyway, but the concept of the best fiscal system, which is hard to say anything is the best. You hope that you've done the best you can on there, but shifting sands again. And so you are continually assessing your competitive position and structuring, making sure you're fulfilling all the things you do under the guise generally of maximizing the value or the benefits of the resource in question to, to your state, your home jurisdiction, whatever it happens to be.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. George, I've introduced a bill that would set up a competitiveness review panel and looking at placing that permanently within the administration so that there would be a continual annual assessment of that. It's been my observation over the last decade that we don't do this very well. We do it sort of haphazardly. One lawmaker will bring it up for political purposes here and there, or perhaps a governor will take it on as an issue, but it doesn't seem to be something that we do with any regularity. We don't seem to use the same sort of variables for input. And my question to you is, where have you seen this done well, and what kind of a system has been done to assess that worldwide competitiveness?
There are a number of different approaches used. There are, as you say, those that only appear in times of crisis or seeming crisis, and so we must do something. We'll go out and make an assessment, and that certainly takes place. You do have under various systems the reports of the ministries or regulatory bodies into that are put out again to I know reasonably well from both the UK and Norway, but I think Denmark as well do regular annual reports. You can go out actually on the website and get a lot of information out on there, and they will talk generally about the how things have been progressing in there. They'll give statistics on activity, maybe information on production and expectations on there. And you actually get annual books. Actually, I suppose we've moved to the web these days, but classically these were books that were put out and constitute an annual report. So that is a form of regular review on there. You also have a lot of private sector, if you like, competitive analysis. People are always putting out, rankings in there, and they are, they're fraught with lots of problems in detail because, you cannot rank on one criteria. It's lots and lots of different criteria, but they surface the issue all the time, and that is more frequent now than it probably was going back, even 5-10 years ago. A lot of that out there right now.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you. And through the chair, if I can just follow up, that's one of our problems. We're ranking at the bottom tier of those private reports that have been published universally. They're being put out by different organizations, but we rank, 49th out of 52 and 143 out of 157 and so on and so forth for competitiveness. And one of the things that we get frustrated about as lawmakers is we don't really know based on what. Some of it's climate, difficulty to access the resource, fiscal regime, regulatory process, et cetera. So we've tried in the bill to sort of address all of the things that we think factor in from a private sector point of view, and it is more than just the fiscal regime, and we're going to take a lot of what you have here too as well. But one of the things that that you brought up that I think is really interesting is just from the perspective of the private sector, and is there any kind of a universal book that you look to or a universal guide, since you have been an expert for 38 years, that you would sort of say in the law there are books that we look to, or in medicine that you look to and say this would be a guideline. These are in the this is in the top five of books that experts like me would say this is a well reputed book. That's question number one. And my final question is, when looking at these regimes, is there anyone that divides it into competitiveness with respect to exploration and production?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, to take the first part of your question, I don't know of a single book, if you like, an annual review that anyone would call definitive. I mean, certainly there are companies that make a living by doing regular publications on these things, but I think as you pointed out yourself there, one of the problems is really understanding what they're ranking by. I mean, to be fair to them, you know, it is difficult. The more factors you bring in, the more subjectivity you bring into it, and therefore, yeah, they will tend to go with things that can be mathematically treated, because you get an answer comes out and then you can sit and rank that. But you know, those publications aside, I don't know of anything that is you know, seen by everyone to be, you know, this is the place to go and look. And the corollary of that is I think if you are concerned with your understanding your own competitiveness from time to time, there is no substitute for doing it yourself, because you really understand at that point what all the factors are that go into this. And you know, yes, you're having to make judgments. You'll realize where the more difficult ones and where the more straightforward ones are. And you'll also got to use measures to see whether your assessment of competitiveness is borne out by the various factors you see going on as well. So you're involved in this sort of review, analyze, feedback process that will build over time your own understanding of doing those things. Mm-hmm. My apologies, I've forgotten the second part of your question.
Sorry, Mr. Sherman. On the second, one of the things that we're eliciting as we review the credit system as well as the tax system, we're finding that the credits that we've put in place, upwards of $4 billion worth of credits, and just in the last 7 years, upwards of $1.5 billion worth of credits, seem to be incentivizing exploration very well. We're getting some excellent results out of that. But there's a question about whether or not the regime that we've put in place for credits, I would say there's not a question at all. The regime that we've put in place for credits have not led to any increased production. In fact, they've led to a decline in production, or not led to, but we've not seen increased production. We've seen a decline in production, and we're expected to see a decline in production for the next 10 years. And so as a result of that, I'm wondering, and we're wondering here in our state, we may want to keep part of the fiscal system that we have and repair another part of it. And when you look around at those fiscal systems, is there any kind of an assessment that tells you these fiscal regimes have it right when it comes to exploratory phases, and these have it right when it comes to the producing phases?
Again, I don't know any single source that would you would go to and look up and say, okay, here's sort of 1, 2, 3 that have it right, you know, at time A or time window A and another at time window B and so on. I think that's just a question of spending enough time looking at where places have been, which countries generally are deemed to have been successful and what they have done, and looking at those, you know, the nature and structure of their regimes and where they have changed or not changed. How they're managing for very different circumstances as well. You also have to take that into account in
looking at these things, and again, excuse me for going back to the North Sea, it's somewhere I know reasonably well, but yeah. I think there is a fairly good example by comparison there between the way the UK had decided to manage its resources and Norway decides to manage its resources. Norway is a country of, you know, 4 or 5 million people with, and both parts of the North Sea have generally similar resource bases, so you're not talking about anything wildly different there. You know, one's a country of 50, 60 million people, one's of 4 or 5 million people. You know, the needs of both parts are quite different. In one, it's a major, major part of the economy. In the other, it's, you know, maybe 5% of the economy or at one time was. So its relative importance is quite different, and therefore the way you try and manage it is also different as well.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be brief. I know we're getting way behind here. When your office presented to the House Resources back in February, there was a slide called Producer's View of Fiscal Systems. It's not in this. And one of the headlines there, it says, never met a tax they liked, clearly. And then you talked about Illinois and how Illinois has the lowest government take, but nobody invests in Illinois because there's not very much oil there. And then you had Iraq, which has the highest government take, and then there's a huge investment by big oil there. But one of the other things that was said on that slide was it's always making comparisons to lower 48 as best place to invest. And I remember going back to the ACES debate how this was something that we talked about quite a bit. Who are our peers? Who should we be comparing ourselves to? And I believe it was your office that had told us, I know we heard this over and over again, that our comparables, it was not appropriate to compare us to the lower 48 because they're not sovereign jurisdictions. They don't own the oil like Alaska does. And that it was really more appropriate for us to compare ourselves to places like Norway or Great Britain or Russia. Is that still your view of things?
Yes, I think there are two components to that. One is the sort of comparison that you've made there, that the state does here in Alaska owns the resource and therefore has a very different duty in looking at it too in most of the rest of the United States where it's private landowners that are, you know, that are the financial beneficiaries of it. So that's one component. But there is a sort of another element of the component, and that's just a structural one within the industry, and that companies will tend to put their budgets in regional pots. There's no law that says they have to do it. That is just the way they have a tendency to do it. And therefore, when looking at regional budgeting to the extent it exists, the fact that they may have opportunities in the Gulf of Mexico or North Dakota or, you know, in the Marcellus Shale or whatever it happens to be that they're chasing at that point in time, they may be looking at their budgets in that form. So I don't think it's irrelevant to do it. I think to look at other parts of the lower 48, but I think you are dealing with a different situation, and in that sense you're managing your resource much more comparably to other nations as opposed to states.
Thank you, Mr. George. Need to start.
Stop. Yes. Moving on.
Yes.
Okay. So, where is Alaska Day? Again, I hopefully can move through this a bit more quick because a lot of these points have come up already on there. Despite the prices, despite everything, production is continuing to decline. Some component of that may be what you would expect. Just as you move through life, the degree of the decline, you know, we can argue, is it faster than it might be, or could it be slower if there was more activity on there? There is obviously the issue of TAPS still, and there was testimony this morning with regard to the point at which, you know, TAPS becomes a critical issue if it hasn't become one already in there. And whether it's an operational limit or an economic limit, or economics can change the operational limit, there are a lot of questions still out there. But it is vitally important because it is your one connection to the market in there. And that is something, obviously, that I won't say is unique to Alaska because there are other places that have similar considerations, but it's a powerful factor in there. You have a large amount of resource that is known about in there in the heavy oil. The technology and the economics of unlocking it are obviously going to be critical in there. The other resource plays in terms of shale oil, if that may come to be, and the extent to which that might provide flow of oil into the system if it can prove to be economic, and obviously it'd be really interesting to see how that goes in the future. Any resources that are stranded out there, are there infrastructure access issues? That's a sort of regulatory issue for for any regulator to be concerned about that people are not disadvantaged as a result of the situation to be able to get stuff to market and make it uneconomic. You know, it is a logistically challenged and high-cost area. There's no real getting away from that. It's something you have to deal with and factor in. And that's also reflected in the next point about the lead times generally to get stuff on stream. And what that's a surrogate for saying is it adds to the economic challenge of anything because of time value money and so on. But and the players you have again an unusual situation where you have some very dominant players with large legacy properties, and then you also have a lot of new players that are playing to, I won't say a different set of rules, but they've got a different set of parameters associated with their activity as well. So you do in some respects have a couple of camps to look at in there. Future scenarios. Would that this was a nice easy question to answer in there, but you have to look at a lot of things in there. At a point Rich made when he presented this slide previously was there are a gazillion little things in there, and anything we put up or somebody else puts up, you can go in and you can nitpick at it and say, I don't think it's there, I think it's over there. But what is really important to try and separate the noise, those little components from the bit much bigger picture to understand, you know, is do we think we've got everything right? Are we making everything as straightforward as we can? On the one hand, for people to come in and play and do activity, but at the same time still taking what is a reasonable share given the risk and reward balance on there and trying to get a judgment on
that. Mr. George, what I'd like you to focus on, if you could, in this area is that it seems like Alaska doesn't have the data transparency that many other regimes, you know, or areas of the world have. And what I would like for you to do is comment, if you could, on Alaska's need for data transparency.
If I may be permitted, I'll separate that into two parts. There's the data and the transparency. And I'd further like to separate out, because the issue, the debate here in the past has also gone to the issue of taxpayer data, and we can't disclose taxpayer data. And so I'd like to separate out the idea of financial data that belongs to taxpayers that's generally backward-looking and what you might call operational data or planning data that is not related to the economics of anything particularly, but is what people are looking at and the opportunities on there. So you have a bit of a matrix in there between information provision, the way it's provided or the cover under which it's provided, and then the disclosure, which may or may not occur as a result. And certainly, this was an issue back in 2007 when the ACES hearings went on. My understanding is it has improved significantly since then. There's a lot more information than there was. But whether it's gone as far as is typically seen in a lot of other countries, I think, is perhaps a more open question. And I honestly, I don't know the full answer to that. But the sense I get from what is said is that it's not there yet. Many countries, and again, I checked on this actually quite recently, and I had a conversation with someone in the relevant ministry in the UK. The regulations actually allow the ministry to ask for pretty much anything they want. And they do ask for quite a lot. They will get a lot of information from the companies, particularly in the early stages of field development. They will see the development plans. They will know what the production outlook and the alternatives and the development plan has to be approved anyway before they go ahead. So they will get a lot of information. But the disclosure on that is actually relatively limited. It's so for planning purposes they have a lot. What goes into the public domain is much, much less. So if you're talking about transparency, that's perhaps a slightly harder one to answer. Norway requires that companies report twice a year in a spreadsheet on the forecast. You can actually go and you can't see all the numbers underneath it, but you can see the form of reporting if you go onto the website there. Around other countries, you know, Iraq is one example on there, but it would substitute for a lot of others. Everything you do is subject to submitting plans and having them approved so that the regulator knows what's going on there. But the disclosure on that is actually relatively limited. It doesn't go outside, the ministry itself for the most part. So I don't know if I fully answered your question there, but there's a number of different components to it.
Well, it brings up an interesting issue. You know, we have about a half an hour left, and we have quite a number of slides. And what it does, you know, I think what we're receiving today is kind of a 20 or 30,000 foot view. And I think the committee certainly would appreciate it, your coming back and maybe getting into more of the specifics in a couple of weeks if that schedule could be accommodated. Is that something that we could arrange?
If we're talking a couple of weeks in the general sense of the word, I'm sure we could. I actually am on the road for the next 2 weeks specifically, but I'm happy to try and work with the committee and so on through the department.
Again, we need to try to get through these questions, but Senator Wilikowski is
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at this slide, and I know when you presented this or when Rich presented this back in February in the House, there was a section in there that said lack of data transparency that many regimes have. And then there was another slide where you talked about data transparency, and you said relative to other regimes, Alaska is handicapped in its decision-making by the small amount of either confidential or reliable public data on energy operations. And I'm just curious if you believe that situation has been alleviated in the last month or why that's been removed from the presentation. I know this is something that I've seen memos on it going back looking at ACES documents from years ago. Is this something that you still consider to be a handicap for Alaska? And I know I've asked for the Department of Revenue to provide ways that we can close the gaps on data transparency for the last 3 weeks. I'm still waiting for the information. Any comment?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. My understanding, and I have to say it is an understanding, I have not got a lot of detail on this, is that it has improved from where it was in 2007. But it wasn't at a very good level in 2007. It probably has a lot further it would go to be comparable to most other countries and outside of the U.S., including Canada, to the level where the same sort of disclosure would be going on. But again, I'd separate transparency from data provision. I'd separate taxpayer from planning or operational data, however you wish to describe it on that.
Thank you.
Please continue, Mr. George. And again, we got to.
Sure. Okay. This was just a slide to put a bit of context in there. And Senator McGuire really alluded to this one earlier. I mean, in last year, I understand that oil taxes and royalties, the take from the oil industry, was sort of 90% of the unrestricted general fund revenue. Whatever the exact number, it is the economy of here. If you take the big three companies, and it depends on what measure you want to use, and again, I don't want to focus too much on the exact numbers, but it's a much smaller part of their economy, and therefore the relative, although I would hesitate to ever suggest that Alaska was not important to them, and that isn't the point, it's the relative scale is different for the different parties, and therefore the way people are going to look at it is going to come out differently on there as well. There's obviously a lot of questions out there at the moment on there. Is it necessary to make a change to ACES? Is it necessary to make a change now? If I do it, am I going to get the same investment I was going to get anyway or not? Or if I do make a change to investment and the presumption that the change of investment should lead to more production, although, there are always questions about that, where you're directing it, but how much more? the issue with TAPS, is it entirely dependent on the production profile that the forecast that we're looking there, or is there oil that could come from other places, including the offshore or elsewhere on federal lands? But that's not an area where the state actually controls anything. You're sort of having to cross your fingers and hope if you go for that one there. How long can you, taking all of this, you don't have, we're not just talking about data disclosure, but you just don't have perfect data to work with. No one has perfect data. This is not an Alaska-specific issue. You don't have perfect data. But given all these other factors, how long can you wait before you get comfortable that the likely outcome? Well, The only certain point I can give you on that curve is when you look back at the end of the day, you know exactly what it was. But you know what going forward is there, and how long can you wait given these factors, and then so step back from all that. What can you influence, and how can you influence it? And there are certain things, and you know the term levers is often used for the certain levers that are in your control that you can play with if you think it's necessary to do so. Again, my apologies, obviously, for staying high level here. When I know some of you would like to go somewhat lower in there, but I just put up some metrics in there so that we had perhaps a sense of some numbers that are out there. And the issue of the rate of decline has often been talked about on there. And what are we doing? Right at the moment, we're sitting at about 6%. The companies have indicated in the past that the 3% ought to be achievable given the right level of investment in there. And what does that mean? Well, it depends when you take TAP's economic limit to be, but maybe it's 1.5 to 2 billion barrels. It's the difference between those two sets of declines out there. 150,000 barrels a day difference in production for 20 years. Well, that's actually sort of the level you see between the 3 and the 6% decline once you get out a few years. That's like 1 billion barrels of oil, the difference in you get there. You know, delaying things because they're not done till later rather than they're done now, well, that's a time value of money issue. What sort of metrics do we look at on the time value of money? Well, you know, it halves, depending on the discount rate you use, somewhere between, let's say, 10 years, plus or minus 10 years, 7 to 15 up there. What does some of this mean to the state in terms of the opportunity value of achieving things if one move will get you one thing and one will another? $100 a barrel, which is roughly where we are today in the market in there, is worth to the state, undiscounted, on there about $40 under the ACES regime, and about $30 depending on whether it's a new field or existing field area under SB 49 in there. And at $150 a barrel, it's worth somewhere between $50 and $75, depending on there. So there's some sort of rough things to keep in your mind when you're going forward. If you put that another way and put it sort of into the profiles on there, if you got 150,000 barrels a day for 20 years by doing something, if you were ever able to say so, you that would be worth about $30 billion to the state over that time there. If you,
Mr. Chairman, Senator French,
and just so I keep frame of reference, what would that be worth to the industry? That 150,000 barrels times 20 years.
Good question. I have the number, but not in my head. My apologies. If I can get back to you.
Email it to the chairman, and he'll send it around. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Distribute it to all the committee members. So, anyway, please continue, Mr. George. Trying to get through the end.
Sure. And then again, I looked at $100 a barrel where we are, and maybe 150 as a higher number if that's where things were to go in the future. In there, so $30 to $60 billion range. And then if you made a change in the nature of SB 49 and nothing actually changed in there, what might it end up costing you? Well, $10 to $25 billion would be the sort of numbers that would come out of there. What's the value of delaying getting something that you might otherwise do, leaving aside the issue of what happens with TAPS? Well, $20 to $40 billion, that sort of range. We also looked, and these are repeats of slides again that my colleague gave previously, although I think with not a change to the numbers, but some additional stuff in there. Again, it's to try and, as Rich put it, set some goalposts out there at sort of either end, thinking that probably reality lies somewhere between those points in there, even if we don't know exactly where it's likely to be. And we looked at saying, okay, what happens if the North Slope generally declines away at 6% a year, and what happens if it performs according to the DOR fall forecast from last year? And the difference between those over the time to 2050 is a bit under 2 billion barrels, 1.75 billion barrels on there. And what you know, what comes out is if you associate the 6% decline with the current status quo, and that you get a relatively early demise to TAP's pipeline, but through making a change, you are able to achieve a profile like the department's profile in there, and you manage to keep TAPs going longer through appropriate investment and everything else like that. There's about $100 billion potential gain that's sitting in there.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a number of questions on this slide, and I'm just curious why you chose a 6% decline when the Department of Revenue is predicting, I believe, I thought it was a 2% decline. You say it's a 4% decline.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the decline depends on the shorter term or the longer term. The 4%, I think, is about 3.5, and it was rounded at 4 on the slide, is out to about 2040, is the average on there. 6% is the level that we're sitting at in the last, I think, average for the last 2 or 3 years, is sitting at around about that level, and it's a number that you know the industry had used in prior times as saying, you know, at current levels of investment, we would expect about a 6% decline. At higher levels of investment, we think we can hold it at 3%.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, you also assume no new major investment, and I'm wondering if you could remodel this, taking into account the $768 million that Repsol has said they plan on investing on the North Slope, and also the investment proposals made by Great Bear. Could you remodel that and get us some numbers?
Senator Wilkowski, yes, it's certainly possible to make assumptions as to things and get outcomes as well.
And then if I could, Mr. Chair, I'm just curious why you used an undiscounted cash flow for this slide. Is that standard practice for a business when comparing two different investment scenarios over time?
No, when I would agree with you that when you're making investment decisions, you would not be looking at the undiscounted numbers there. The reason that it was done at the time it was prepared was to try and get away from issues of what discount rate to use for the state and whether that was the same that you would use for the company and so on. So it was just putting the numbers out on there. But it's possible to provide the same. You get different absolute numbers, but the same general picture if you used it. A discount as well.
And if I could, because the two ACES data that you show there, $95 billion and $110 billion, goes through the 2020s, and then the SB 49 you have out to 2050. So it doesn't look like a true apples-to-apples comparison. But if you could do are you able to use a discounted slide flow? Do you have any sense of what the value would be, the values would be, say 10%?
10% discount rate.
Yeah. Is that, or whatever is common, whatever you would recommend?
Senator Wilkowski, I mean, certainly we're happy to look at perhaps a couple of discount rates rather than saying this is the right one, because it's obviously a sensitive issue for individual parties as to what the appropriate discount rate is. But if we can certainly provide it at different discount rates, and you can, you know, take your own view on there.
If we could just quickly return to slide 10, and in there you indicate at $100 a barrel, the state's take is approximately $40. You know, there's some people are saying that the state's take at $100 a barrel is 82%. You know, so what I'm trying to do is, can you explain, you're saying it's 40, others are saying it's 82%.
Mr. Chairman, my apologies, because I didn't put enough explanation into that. That $40 was on that was a sort of over the life of an investment and assuming $100 a barrel. So it takes out the fact there are costs are coming out of there as well. When you're talking about the 78% or 68 or 72 or some other number there, that's typically a share of the revenue after costs in there. This is looking at the whole of the life, so you'd be taking out, you know, some $20-$30 a barrel out of there and then looking at the share after that, which is why you see the state gets a lower proportion of the ultimate sales price.
Are we jumping back forward, or Senator Wilikowski, did you have any?
I do. And can you talk to me about page slide 14? You in the right, you say TAPS enhancement. Can you talk about what TAPS enhancement you're referring to, or you're assuming?
Senator Cassidy, whatever would be necessary to keep it flying through to 2050. It's not non-specific. If I could just step back again to the point, the object on these was to try and set out some goalposts, some points at either end of the field, if you like, that said, you know, what if this or what if that, and therefore it was just taking a set of assumptions and said, okay, we can keep it, however we do it, we can keep it flowing to 2050 at lower production rates, if necessary, than are currently envisaged in there.
Yeah, thank you. And then can you also talk about what discovered fields you're talking about that you believe will be discovered under SB 49 that would not be discovered under ACES?
Senator Cassidy, that's not what the discovered there means. It merely means it's the existing producing fields and the existing discovered fields as well. So we can certainly put some clarification on exactly what goes into the profile there. But that is the DOR fall 2010 forecast.
Continue.
If we pass SB 49, do you have any sort of prediction on which fields would be brought into development as opposed to if we don't pass SB 49?
Senator Murkowski, I really don't on that.
Can you give us any sort of prediction about how much more oil will be produced under SB 49 as opposed to under ACES?
I'd love to be able to tell you. I could say exactly, but I don't know. As under one regime or another, I don't know what the difference would be. That is, I mean, everybody's really hard call at this point is what happens if I do it, what happens if I don't do it, or something else as well. What happens if I do something else?
You know, Mr. George, if I could interject, you know, I just did a rough calculation at 600,000 barrels a day. That's approximately 200 million barrels per year. So it takes us 5 years to pump a billion barrels. And that means it takes us 40 years to pump 8 billion barrels. You're, you know, on page 14, you're out 40 years from now approximately. But that 8 billion barrels, you know, the reserves are currently 5 billion barrels, and then the undiscovered potential recovery are another 4 billion barrels. So we only have 9 billion barrels, whether they're incentivized or not incentivized, according to the facts. So if we're out 40 years pumping 600,000 barrels, we're within a billion barrels of the end of reserves and the end of undiscovered potentially recoverable. Is that accurate or inaccurate?
Mr. Chairman, the ultimate recovery under the SB 49 column on there is about 5.5 billion. It's the full profile, and because it's not constant at 600,000 a day, it declines off. May I go back to slide 10 again?
What I'm trying to
focus. Sorry, slide 13 there, yeah.
Which slide?
This is the slide 13, the prior one. So it's the top of that light green line, the light green shaded area on there. Is the production profile there, and that's, I think, about 5.5 billion barrels.
And this is total or total plus enhanced?
No, the assumption in this set of slides is that is what you achieve. That is the level under these economic runs that were there, that the total production under it is 5.5 billion barrels.
And so the lighter shade is 1.75, and then the other is 3.75.
Three and a quarter, 3.5, yes.
And so the total of that is that consumes all of the known reserves currently.
Mr. Chairman, I have to be very careful with the term reserves, because it is also a term of art and has certain connotations to it, but it is certainly not all the reserves and resources that are known to be out there. It is certain fields that either are currently producing or are under development or are under appraisal and are identified by the Department of Revenue in its full forecast, and we're happy to get details for you of exactly what is in there. And then, you know, everything else is not in there right now. There's no heavy oil in there, for example.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just under your assumptions where it says slide 14, it says continued decline, and some of the assumptions you made were that no new major investment would occur. And being that since we passed ACES 3 years ago, we've had a 50% increase in capital investment on the North Slope. We have projections of continued increases on capital expenditures in 2011 and 2012, and we'll see about the other years. Can you recreate this slide, assuming the new level investment we've actually seen in the past 4 years? And I don't need it right now, but if you could get something, that's it.
Be happy to look at some additional cases in there and some additional assumptions.
And then, if I could, Mr. Chair, you also assume no TAPS enhancement. And do you have a sense, if we've heard different varying things about when TAPS will no longer be able to operate, if the oil companies were to stop, or when are you assuming that TAPS will cease to carry oil in this assumption?
Senator Wilkowski, in these particular examples, the bar that's got 95 on it assumes that TAPS ceases to operate at 250,000 barrels a day, and the one that says 110, it goes to 200,000 barrels a day.
If I could, Mr. Chair, and what year do we achieve 250,000 barrels per day?
I can tell you, I could look up and get back to you with an exact year, but it's in the mid 2020s and late 2020s in those two cases.
And then, if I could, Mr. Chair, do you have any sense of what it would cost to enhance TAPS to carry to be able to carry 250,000 barrels per day, and whether or not there was what the cost benefit analysis would be if the oil companies would strand 250,000 barrels versus making the adjustments to enhance TAPS?
Senator Wilkowski, I'm sorry, we've done no work on that, and I don't know if it's even a very easy question to answer, but I accept that it's obviously a very important question as to exactly, you know, what TAPS is capable of doing and what things that could be done to change its operating parameters.
I think as a part of that, assuming the shutdown as depicted on slide 14 in under the 95 or the 110, whatever the flow rate that is over that lifetime, what is the volume of reserves that would still be left in the ground, and what is the volume of undiscovered, potentially recoverable, that would still be left in the ground?
Mr. Chairman, I'll have to get back to you on exactly, well, when you say what's left in the ground in terms of at shutting down at 200 or 250, the issue is down to what level. If you took it all the way down to zero, I can find out the answer for you fairly quickly, but it's the difference between 200 and 250 and some other level where you're able to operate it down to. So if you could keep it going by certain investments down to 100,000, we can do the sums and tell you exactly how much oil would continue to be produced between 200,000 barrels a day and 100, for example, in there. But in terms of how much undiscovered is not there, I mean, I don't think anyone can answer that question. Obviously, what we know is that if it shuts down then and nothing else happens, the heavy oil resource hasn't gone down there.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. You've certainly followed the developments on the North Sea, or not the North Sea, Chukchi, Beaufort Seas, potentially billions and billions of barrels of oil. Potentially billions of barrels on the North Slope in heavy oil, potentially billions of barrels with shale oil. Do you think it's reasonable to assume the oil companies would leave that amount of oil stranded?
Senator Walkowski to the chair. No, I don't think anyone would leave anything stranded if they thought there was a viable economic proposition in terms of, and I mean, and regulatory regime that would allow them to get at it as well. If it was viable, no. I mean, I don't think any rational person would.
Please continue, Mr. George.
Thank you. So just to briefly recap, saying goalpost maybe at one end under those two conditions was $100 billion of upside in there. And then on the downside, what happens if you make a change such as SB 49 and nothing actually changes and you carry on and get a 6% decline before tax abandonment, then you've foregone about $20 billion in fiscal take for the state. If you make the you made no change or you kept ACEs and you got the investment necessary to do what provides the DRR profile, then the difference there is $50 billion between SB 49 and ACEs. So somewhere between $20 and $50 billion on the downside would be, you know, making a change but not actually changing the outcome any in there. So that was sort of trying to put some parameters on either side as to what we may be talking about on here.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When do the two lines cross? This, you know, we start giving the money back this year and we get the increased production tax value in future years. When do those lines cross? When do we start seeing more money in state coffers from SB 49 if it does indeed lead to more production?
Senator French, to the chair, I think, well, there's two parts. When do you start seeing more money, or when do you, I mean, more money as in money coming back, or when do you actually have a net gain on the situation?
Both questions are important.
Yeah. The expectation as to when you might start to get more, at relatively small volumes, you could do it in a year or two afterwards if it's infield activity, because some of that stuff could take place fairly quickly. In terms of revenue from new exploration, a little bit longer. I believe there was a presentation, I don't know if it was yesterday or relatively recently, that said, you know, one of the attributes, if you like, of the North Slope is that it's a long lead time to get stuff going, and I think 6 years was quoted as, you know, the short end of the you know, what we've seen in the past on there, plus the time to, that's from discovery, so plus the time to plan and then explore. So, you know, 7 to 12 years, I don't know, something either side of 10 years might not be an unreasonable expectation for when you start to get, you know, meaningful flows from exploration activity coming in there.
If you start calculating in the time value of money, it gets harder and harder, does it not?
It depends on the volume that you attract at the end.
You
of
certainly
the day.
Need more volume as you go further into the future.
It is very volume dependent. Now, obviously, cost as well, but volume dependent. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, if I'm reading these numbers correctly. We've heard varying numbers about what this Senate Bill 49 will actually cost the state. What your testimony is today and what I read this slide as is that from 2011 through 2020, if we pass Senate Bill 49, it will cost the state $20 billion. And from 2011 through 2050, it will cost the state $50 billion. Is that accurate?
Senator Walkowski, through the chair, that would be if nothing changed as a result of the bill passing. In other words, you've got the same outcomes under ACEs or SB 49, then those would be the differences that are calculated under the assumptions that went in here.
And if Follow up. Okay, so we pass this, everything stays the same, we lose $50 billion from 2011 through 2050. And you have, if I recall your testimony correctly, you don't know that SB 49 will add a single drop of oil to the production of, you don't know that it will add a single drop of oil in production or that it will result in a single new exploration well being drilled. Is that fairly characterizing your testimony?
Senator Wilkowski through the chair. I'm not sure that I put it quite like that, or I would put it quite like that. I don't know exactly what result it will have. That is certain. I would assume directionally it will give improvement because there is more money in the system, but exactly what comes out, I don't know at the end of the day. And that's really a question the companies have to give a better indication on.
Further questions? We really are at 5 o'clock, and I thank Mr. George, and again with the potential for you to return in a couple of weeks if that is possible through my staff, if you could make arrangements and we can coordinate that. But with that, we thank Mr. George and Gaffney Klein and Associates for appearing today. With that, Senate Resources is adjourned.